going to pick up on in a tangential way on the conversation from the last hour as we welcome here to Issues Etc. our good friend and regular guest, Uwe Simonetto, for the first half hour of the second hour of Issues Etc. We're going to start our conversation talking about, based upon an analysis that he did for UPI, subduing the universe. We're going to talk about the various views of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam vis-a-vis science and exploration, in particular, going out into space, something that's been on the mind of people tragically reminded by the destruction of Space Shuttle Columbia on Saturday. And we'll also talk with Uwe about peace movements and whether or not peace movements within the church will reenact the mistakes they made after the Vietnam War, as war seems inevitable for our country, and the president seems to be at odds with his own church body, the United Methodist Church, on the issue of war. They seem to be actually standing on two opposite ends of the same pole, and we'll find out what Uwe has to say about that in the course of this hour. A little later in the hour, we'll be talking with Dr. Ann Hendershot, professor of sociology at the University of San Diego, about Black Americans and abortion. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from New York. He is also editor and contributor to the new book called One Incarnate Truth. Uwe, welcome back.
Thanks to be back. Wonderful.
Well, now let's see what the various views. Some would assume that in this modern age, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam all take the same approach to the issues of science. Is this true?
Not exactly. I mean, Christianity and Judaism certainly do. There is a subtle difference on the side of Islam. And the difference is this, that, Luther called the man God's cooperator, which, of course, modern Lutheran theology would then even extend into being God's co-creator in the process of ongoing creation, which absolutely squares with Jewish theology. This doesn't square with Islamic theology simply because Islam sees God as the creator and us as only as creatures, but does not make the link between the creator and the reason for why he's created us, which is, of course, to participate as partners of God in the ongoing creation.
So the Islamic view takes a far more, well, I'm trying to attach a term to this, but makes a stronger distinction between God as creator and man as creature, whereas you would say the Jewish and the Christian view, by God's allowance, man is allowed to, say, in the case of procreation, continue the creative activity of God.
That's precisely that, and participate fully in it. And, as you know, for example, a rabbi, a friend of mine in New York, an Orthodox rabbi, a friend, interprets the command, fill the earth and subdue it, as meaning fill the universe and subdue it. And you're all right, so until now we've filled the earth and subdued it, but the universe is still to be subdued. And therefore, space exploration and flights out there and everything else is very much within the creative process that God allows us to participate in. Whereas on the Muslim side, they would say, well, God has given us this garden, and you, man, are the gardener in it. Exploited well, but you're the gardener. So we have, in other words, the human being has a higher rank in Christianity and Judaism than it has in Islam.
Now, the issue has come to the floor about whether or not human lives ought to be, albeit unintentionally, expended in the cause of exploration or in the pursuit of scientific knowledge. We had a terrible reminder of this, of course,
right,
on Saturday. What is the Judeo-Christian view here as opposed to that of the Muslim view?
Well, the Judeo-Christian view is that we are fallible, so therefore we do make mistakes, and that also costs human lives, always has cost human lives in past explorations, and it will cost human lives And of course, we also know that these human lives that are lost are not really lost, but wind up in God's hands. At least the Islamic scholar I've talked to here, a man I respect very highly, is the director of research at the Institute of Astrophysics in Paris. He says, well, no, we should be more careful with that unless we are more certain that that we are not going to lose lives. We should, you know, rather use unmanned space flights until we can be more certain. Obviously, there's never a total certainty there, but there's, again, a subtle difference. It is not vast, but there's a subtle difference, and the subtle difference is that as we are made in the image of God, which all three theologies affirm, but as we are made in the image of God, of course, we have to take risks as well. And then as Christians and Jews, we know that wherever we screw up, God ultimately will put things right again, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer said.
Now, I'm curious about kind of the historical perspective on this, because it is my understanding that Islam, especially earlier, closer to its roots in its early history, was a great stimulus. This way of thinking, this worldview, was a great stimulus for people in the Arabic world and elsewhere to pursue knowledge and to pursue science and to pursue mathematics and philosophy.
Right.
Yet today in the 21st century, the commonly held opinion about Islam is that it's kind of Luddite. It is against science, knowledge, and the pursuit of these things.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there is, for example, the man I'm citing in my article, Bruno Ghidardoni, is very much part of this process of the scientific progress. He is simply a little more subtle and a little more restrained in many ways. But yes, indeed, there is. I mean, it's like in all forms of fundamentalism that you rather withdraw into yourself and say, well, we better not make this mistake, and we better not make that mistake. I mean, these people back 1,000 years ago, these Muslims, were of course driven by their curiosity as human beings and as children of God. So then, of course, since 1,000 years ago, they have withdrawn into their shell, and I think this is where we have to get them out of, actually, so if we want to have any form of discourse with them.
And do you think that the two different views, what I'm hearing, especially in the near aftermath of Columbia's destruction, is a lot of the public opinion in America being, well, look, if it costs one life, it costs too much. Therefore, we really ought to just not pursue this any longer. It does cost lives. There's no doubt about it. Your response?
Well, my response is actually, I'd like to quote somebody, a woman called Karen Mulder from University of Virginia, who just sent me this very, about half an hour ago, an email saying, does this mean that we're not going to drive anymore, that we're not getting in a boat anymore, that we're not getting on an airplane anymore, that we're not doing any of these pursuits anymore, which are very, very human? You can't. I mean, it is very simply this. I personally think that anybody who, out of curiosity and in the service of God, obviously, and then these were people of faith, at least many of those people were killed, they went out there to pursue a task given to us by God, which is to explore this world and subdue it for ourselves. And so, therefore, I think we ought to do it, and we risk this, and it's very, very tragic and that it happens, but it happens.
Why do nations dominated by radical Islam curtail things like scientific pursuits, exploration, and whatnot?
Well, I think they curtail it because what we all know as Christians, the wonderful freedom that the gospel gives us is not there for these guys. You know, it's dangerous. It must be dangerous. If you are a fundamentalist, if you're a radical Muslim, and you have the choice between the freedom of serving God and serving God in outer space, serving God down here on earth, if you don't have that freedom and you just become somebody who submits to the will of God or presumed will of God, that is the issue. So now radical Muslims Osama bin Ladens of that type, all these radical mullahs in Iran, cannot stand and cannot tolerate and support the freedom that one feels as one is serving God. So therefore, I think it's a false religion.
Let's change the subject then and talk a little bit about your time as a war correspondent,
right,
and especially after the Vietnam War. What did you witness happening in Christian churches, in some Christian churches, for Vietnam vets who were returning after that war?
Well, let me proceed this by saying I worked as a chaplain intern in a VA in Minnesota. And this is part of my theological studies. And there I founded a group, a therapy group, together with, by the way, Christian psychologists for Vietnam veterans. And it turned out that virtually all of the people in our group and people I beyond that, people I met doing ministry in that hospital, had been rejected upon their return to the United States. They were Vietnam veterans. They came back. They were chucked out of their churches. Priests or pastors, when a guy came in with a crew cut, would say, "Get out of here. You have no business being in here." Or they came out in uniform. After the service, they would say, "Well, don't come back wearing a uniform or wearing a crew cut." Some were refused communion, both in Catholic and Protestant churches. It was a major scandal which has never really been exploited and explored properly by the media.
And what were the reactions of these Vietnam vets when they were turned out by their churches, having returned from this war?
Well, the reaction of Vietnam veterans was that they felt they had, well, they flipped off God. This is their own expression, flipping off God, which did not mean that they did not believe in God, but which meant that God had already rejected them for one reason or another, which they could not comprehend. And so therefore, they became anti-God, even though they believed in God. And the result was drug addiction, alcohol addiction, and especially suicide. And more people have died here in the United States as a result of their treatment by civilians in this country and very much clergy. They committed suicide. There are all sorts of deaths, alcohol-related, drug-related deaths as a result of that. It's actually one of the darkest chapters, I believe, in any military history.
And without respect to whether or not the Vietnam War itself was a just pursuit or a sensible pursuit, do you see reason for concern today on the eve, or what it appears to be, the eve of another war from within the churches about reviving some of the old failed ideologies and even some...
Yes, absolutely. This, you have the same rhetoric, even worse. Well, at this point, even before the war started, Bush is being compared to Hitler. You have a rhetoric from throughout the faith community, which is I find quite baffling, including the Roman Catholics, that sort of places really the soldier in the camp of evil, because somehow they have come to the conclusion that war is not the way to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And so therefore, if you do that, preemptive war is against the laws of God, it's against the theologies of Thomas Aquinas and Martin Luther and others. And so we are back then. It's more often than not the same characters, same name. So 35 years later, you have the same issue all over again.
I was recently reading John Shelby Spong. I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Oh, yes, alas, yeah.
He has written an article, a column on BeliefNet.com that came out a couple weeks ago, and it's talking about the war.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised to find the cynicism from a man that I believe to be, although wrong in almost every respect,
yeah,
clearly intelligent, the cynicism about the war with Iraq. Regardless of what someone believes about Iraq, he seemed to buy every cockamamie notion about why we're going to war and in the worst possible scenario about what would happen.
You see, Todd, and this is what I reproached him for, is the utter intellectual dishonesty. Now, I don't know whether we should. I'm not a military man. I'm not a spook. I don't know whether we should go to war or not. But I know one thing. A man of the cloth who is trained to do totally different things is even less competent to judge these things. And people like Spong know that. They know they have no idea. And they don't even give a hoot about what's going to happen if America does not take out Saddam Hussein with this guy having all these weapons of mass destruction, which I, as a journalist, have researched extensively 3, 4, 5 years ago. We know what is there. We know the dangers that are there. And these guys say, well, it doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. As long as we are good and safe, you know, that's all that matters, you see.
And then finally, do you believe, as you observe this as a journalist, that the peace movement, as it is called, has the same momentum, the same impetus as it did in the times of the 60s and the 70s?
It might have if the war drags on, but I don't think right now, for the time being, the majority of the Americans and, in fact, the world population, but certainly the Americans are behind the government. Of course, if it drags on, if they make strategic and tactical errors, then, yes, indeed, it might have the same impact. Americans are not the most patient people in the world, as you know. So their attention span is limited. But if they're swift with it, if the military, I mean, they've had enough time to plan this, if they can take him out fast, I think they're going to win the day and not the peace movement.
Real briefly, can you explain to me Germany's opposition to this whole enterprise?
I wish I could. I am so depressed about it. I've just come back from Germany. I was there last week. I am German, as you know. It is fear, and there's a German saying, Angst ist ein schlechter Ratgeber. Fear is a bad counselor. It is fear. It is they've had too much war in their country. We've had it, and I experienced it as a child. And the church in Germany, all churches in Germany, play a particularly destructive role here, because once again, sort of like the Methodist bishops or whatever in this country, they simply do not think things through. I mean, that we do have a just war doctrine, both in Catholicism and Lutheranism. They don't think things through. People are scared. You travel on trains. You have a feeling, you know, here's this once shining country, you know, and it looks as if a veil were put, a dark veil were put all over it, and as if everybody was starving. They're still the richest nation in Europe, and they still have the longest vacations anywhere. But they are scared beyond wits, and that it isn't scared, and if you're scared, your mind stops working properly.
Now to the issue closer at home with regard to the president and the degree to which he is at odds with his own church body, the United Methodist Church, over the issue of war. What is the position of the United Methodist Church on this issue?
Well, it seems that the 70-odd bishops of the United Methodist Church are primarily liberal Democrats, or at least in that field. Not all of them, but it seems to be that way. And the ones I've talked to come out of this soft, slight left-wing pietistic tradition of the 19th century, and therefore they are anti-war, period. And they don't have a just war doctrine, really, the way we know it as Lutherans or Catholics or others. That's number one. But on the other hand, as Tom Oden, whom you may know, is a very fine Methodist theologian, keeps saying, this huge chasm between the Catholic clergy, the Methodist clergy, and the people in the pews. The people in the pews are behind the president and the bishops. They simply don't listen to the bishops. They don't. They don't worry about what they're saying.
So really, President George W. Bush, as a Methodist and a member of this denomination, is a typical layperson.
Very much so. Yes, he's. In fact, his entire comportment is that of a typical layperson, as opposed to someone a 1960s, 1970s trained Methodist or other mainline theologian.
Now, the United Methodist Church is not alone in its almost unified, its leadership's unified opposition to war, period, or war with Iraq. They have a lot of allies, the National Council of Churches and various others.
Which is led by a Methodist.
They seem not to be able to understand or to be allow for any event in which war would be an option. Am I overstating the case there?
No, you're right. No, you're absolutely right. The National Council of Churches, I think, represents a minority. Now, it may represent a majority, as I said, if things go wrong and the Americans lose patience. But they right now, they represent a minority view in this country. And not only that, they represent an obsolete view because it is all rooted in 1960s, 1970s ideology. And the seminaries have that orientation. But it's very interesting that the more denominations I talk to, denominational leaders I talk to, that the younger ones, young seminarians, Methodist, Lutheran, Episcopal, you name it, have a totally different outlook.
You quote Thomas Oden as saying, of the bishops of the United Methodist Church, they are not considering the consequences of inaction with regard to Iraq.
Right. They don't take a rational view of this. And that is, I don't know whether it's Methodist mushiness or whether it's just general mushiness, which I think it is, but it's mushy. I mean, there's a lot of mushiness. They're very nice guys. You talk to them, they're wonderful people, you know, you would like to meet them for tea. But they do not actually have a rational approach to this thing. Because, I mean, the one question you always have to ask is, all right, supposing we follow your lead there in this thing, what's going to happen? And then they say, well, that is not our business. Then they defer to something else. And, you know, this is the problem. If you do not make a proper distinction between law and gospel and kingdom to the left and kingdom to the right, then, of course, you have a stew here, and then you can never quite tell the meat apart from the potatoes.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you so much for being our guest again.
Thanks for having me.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joined us from New York. He's contributor and editor to this new book called One Incarnate Truth, and you can read Uwe's columns on the internet at upi.com. That's upi.com. All you need to do is type Uwe into the search engine. It's U-W-E there, and you will find his articles there at upi.com. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ann Hendershot. She's professor of sociology at the University of San Diego and author of the new book, The Politics of Deviance, about Black Americans and abortion.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
How does the forgiveness of sins won at the cross get to us today? Can God use water, word, bread, and wine to deliver it? You'll find solid scriptural answers to these questions in a new book called To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. To order To All Eternity, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. Or you can order the book online. Go to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. Call Concordia Publishing House Monday through Friday, 1-800-325-3040, and order our Issues Etc. book of the month, To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity.
1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The loss of the space shuttle Columbia was another tragedy in our country's recent history. Yet President Bush was able to spread a message of God's love through it all. David Brody explains from Washington.
In the words of the prophet Isaiah, lift your eyes and look to the heavens.
It has been quite some time since a president has worn his faith on his sleeve as much as President Bush. His speech to the nation after the Columbia accident had a strong spiritual tone.
Clearly, the president's remarks reflected his own deep faith.
Gary Bauer is president of American Values and says the president's speech really taps into what many people understand in times of crises.
Most Americans, when they're in the foxhole, don't turn first and foremost to Dan Rather or the New York Times or a psychology book. We do talk. We do turn to our Creator.
And in this case, the president did so masterfully. Sarah Ballinger heads up Capital Prayer Partners.
My sense was that the Holy Spirit ministered directly through the president to speak to the hearts of our people in a time of great tragedy and really suffering.
The speech was essentially thrown together in just a few hours. Heading it up was Bush's close advisor, Karen Hughes. After hearing of the tragedy, Hughes opened her Bible, searching for divine inspiration. The president's remarks were a reflection of that.
The crew of the shuttle Columbia did not return safely to Earth, yet we can pray that all are safely home.
Saying just the right words for a grieving nation. For Family News in Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The president is a Methodist and refers to himself as a born-again Christian. He often makes mention of his faith in speeches around the nation. Officials at the White House say the many references to God in the speech following the Columbia disaster was an acknowledgement that sometimes you just can't explain why tragedies happen, but that God offers comfort through it all. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
We thank Reliable Heating and Cooling for being a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO. Here's a few winter heating tips from Reliable. Don't let your furnace filters get dirty. Check the filters at least once a month, replace disposable filters, or clean the permanent ones whenever they do look dirty. Reliable Heating and Cooling performs routine maintenance such as cleaning filters and humidifiers. 8463 Delport Drive, Reliable Heating and Cooling, 314-423-3535.
Are marketing principles compatible with Christian evangelism? Find out with the new book, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Testing the Claims of Church Growth is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Welcome back. For the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc., we're going to be talking with Dr. Ann Hendershot about black Americans and abortions. If you'd like to join us, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A reminder, in the third hour of the program, we'll be talking with Pastor Tom Baker. He'll be live here in Studio A. We'll be talking with him part four of our seven-part weekly series on a theology of the cross versus a theology of glory. And we'll be talking about free will in the third hour of the program. Dr. Ann Hendershot is professor of sociology at the University of San Diego. She is author of the new book, The Politics of Deviance, and she also has written a column for National Review titled Black Americans and Abortion, The Real Racial Disparity. Dr. Hendershot, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much, Todd. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to come and talk about this.
And in this National Review article, you draw a line between two dots, the one dot being the popular opposition by black politicians in the Senate and the House to the draft and abortion. Connect the dots for us.
Well, yeah, I'm a little concerned about the support for the draft by Representative Charles Rangel and John Conyers, because their reasoning is flawed. They complain that the black community will suffer disproportionate casualties in a war because they believe that blacks are more likely than whites as a percentage to come home from war in body bags. And they're just wrong about that. And what I was struck by it was that they're talking about racial disparity, and they're using words like racial disparity in casualty rates, and none of them are really getting the real story, what I think is the real story of racial disparity in casualty rates. So I decided to write an article about what I call the real racial disparity isn't in wartime, that kind of wartime, because even if we look at the Vietnam War, about 12% of the Americans killed in Vietnam were black, and that's a figure proportionate to their numbers in the overall population. And yes, blacks serve, they're real patriots in that they enlist and they serve longer than whites, but they historically have suffered casualty rates in wartime far below participation rates. But I wrote the article because I wanted to say that to bring people's attention to the real racial disparity, which is the disproportionate numbers of black casualties in what I call the war on the unborn. So while Sharpton and the other Democratic presidential hopefuls were celebrating Roe v. Wade at the NARAL gala, the black community, I can see, and statistics show, is decimated by abortion rates that are three times the rate of whites.
Now, this is something that needs to be sorted out statistically, because if you simply look without regard to race, the abortion numbers, it would appear that the abortion numbers among blacks are far lower than those of whites.
Well, sure.
How is it that the proportionality plays into this?
Yeah, the way we look, I'm a sociologist, so I'm big on statistics, and I wouldn't let my students get away with it if they tried to say to me, oh, but there's more whites getting abortions than blacks. Okay, you know, I'll give you that. But what we want to know is abortion ratios and abortion rates. Now, what we mean by abortion rates is the rate per 1,000 women. So for white women, the abortion rate per 1,000 women aged 15 to 44 is three times is lower than for blacks. And for every 1,000 black women, there are 32 abortions as compared to with 11 for every 1,000 white women. So 11 per 1,000 for whites, 32 per 1,000 for blacks.
And
so they have three times the rates of whites.
And so if the numbers of black and white women having abortions were the raw numbers,
right,
were equal, then it would be much easier to see how many more black women are really having,
yes,
abortions.
And another statistic that's even, I think, more interesting is if we look at the numbers of abortions per 1,000 births. So if we just look at the what we call the ratio in sociology, the abortions births ratio, for white women, the abortions births ratio, for white women, it's 184 abortions per 1,000 live births. So less than 200 per 1,000 live births. Well, for black women, it's appalling. It's 543 abortions per 1,000 births. So for every 1,000 births, blacks are having 543 abortions. That's almost three times greater than that for whites.
And that is means that we're really talking that one-third of conceptions among black women are aborted.
Actually, more than a half, because 543 abortions per 1,000 births.
Okay.
If we do, you're right with the one-third statistic, a third of all, of every 1,000 is aborted. But for blacks, it's more than half.
Now, in addition to that, you also found out that the circumstances of the abortions that were performed were somewhat different between
black women get the riskier, scarier, more dangerous abortions. They're more likely to get abortions late in their pregnancies, while white women were significantly more likely to obtain abortions before 8 weeks. Black women and Hispanic women have abortions much later.
Well, I'm going to think like someone who might want to respond in support of the way things are, and that is, look, this is simply an indicator not of any kind of real problem. Yes, it is a problem, but it's a problem of inequity in healthcare,
right,
or in social services, or in education.
I think Todd, you may be right with the numbers late term. You know, maybe there isn't enough care early in pregnancy, but it doesn't explain for the huge differential in the number of abortions.
And what about if one counts regions of the country or individual states? What do we find there?
Well, where there's large black populations, we're seeing huge numbers of abortions. I go state by state, and I don't do this myself. I didn't get this data myself. It's available to your listeners online. If they just go to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, right on the Internet, and you type in abortion surveillance data, and it comes up to you. It's just kind of hard to find it all because there's, you know, dozens and dozens of tables. But, I mean, I go through state by state, and I look at the reported legal abortions by ethnicity, and I look at the percentages. And when you look at some states in some areas of the country, like Washington, D.C., where you'll have nearly all of the abortions, but, I mean, that's not a surprise. But like in D.C., 76% of all abortions are on black women. But, and I guess that's not a surprise because if you look at it as a percentage of the population, blacks make up a large percentage. But we go down and we look at Georgia. 54% of all abortions in the whole state of Georgia are on black women. That's pretty bad. I would think over half of all abortions in Georgia now are on black women. 52% of all abortions in Louisiana are on black women. 65% of Mississippi abortions are of black women's children. That's very bad. I mean, I think it continues a negative. And that's why I'm shocked when I see Sharpton and all of the Democratic candidates for president up on the stage at NARAL saying, we're going to keep this going for you. We want to give you your abortion.
Well, and the idea seems to be put forth, I think actually an argument can be made, as Richard John Newhouse has made recently on this program, that the pro-life movement is really the natural extension of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But the argument is made on the other side, and I'm sure you're well aware, Anne, that the pro-choice movement is really a civil rights movement, a woman's rights movement. What do you make of it?
And it will, I've heard that argument because I'm old enough to remember it when it was first out. And I'm also old enough to remember when this, when Roe v. Wade first came in and sociologists were doing statistics saying how this is going to cure our welfare problem. That, and that's what worries me. It always worried me. Because that's kind of what Margaret Sanger was all about in terms of, you know, let's address the population control of the poor. And I think it's an extension of that. But I do understand that argument. It says we shouldn't have unwanted children. I've heard that argument for a long time. But why are so many unwanted children black children? That's my concern.
How accurate are these statistics, given that some states, and you mentioned in your article, even California, one of the largest and most populous, are not required to accurately report abortion statistics?
California is the only one. Now, Alaska was reluctant to report, but they recently, just last year, have started reporting, but every other state reports. So I have data from each state, and it is available online. This isn't secret data, but nobody really wants to look at it. And when I started looking at it, I started because my students were, you know, sort of falling prey to that argument. Yeah, but most abortions that are performed on white women. And I said, yeah, okay, well, let's look a little more closely. So I made it an assignment, and we looked closely at the data, because I teach a course in social deviance at the University of San Diego. And they were shocked. And even the people, I mean, oh, there's a lot of people that are, you know, even at a Catholic university who are strongly pro-choice. But even pro-choice people, I think, are concerned about the racial disparity in abortion.
Now, there are those who would attach the connection between what you mentioned, Margaret Sanger, her eugenics goals for abortion, and her kind of population control goals, in particular population control among the poor and the indigent. They would make a direct connection there, that this is nothing more than Planned Parenthood and other groups, NARAL, Pro-Choice America, all acting on marching orders given long ago by Margaret Sanger. Do you think it's that simple?
I don't know. My whole book is about this. Who gets to call these tunes? You know, is Margaret Sanger still playing that tune that Planned Parenthood is dancing? I don't know. I really don't know. But when I look closely at who are the strong pro-choice people, and I look at the Catholics for a Free Choice, and throughout my book, I look at where people get their money. And so, yes, Catholics for a Free Choice has gotten more than $10 million from the Ford Foundation. And if you look closely at the Ford Foundation and look at their history, like I know you know, because you certainly know the eugenics movement well, Margaret Sanger, Ford had a certain kind of desire to control the population of the poor. And for him, it wasn't just blacks. It was Eastern Europeans. It was
he had some serious problems there.
Yes, he did. So they're still in the business of controlling population. So I don't think we're paranoid, even though some people would say, some sociologists, that I'm pretty paranoid about this. But to me, if there is a plot, you ought to look at it, you know, and say, hey, where's this money coming from? $10 million to the Renegade, which is not a Catholic group. The Catholic Church has nothing to do with Catholics for a free choice, but it's sort of their way of sticking it to the church for their, you know, anti-abortion stand. And Ford Foundation is happy to give them $10 million over the years.
I'm glad someone is following the money because,
well, yeah,
because this is one of the things that, without resorting to the conspiracy theory, this is one of the things that I think at least ought to be noted as you know, where our money is being spent and where our consumer dollars are actually headed. Let's open the phones here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, thank you for waiting and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I understood your guest to say that only California and another state, the abortion statistics were suspect. I think they're highly suspect in the state of Illinois. And in investigating this for an article that I wrote, I did call the state of Illinois, and they told me that statistics were submitted, but there's no way that you can know, that I can, as a taxpayer, find out from what clinic the statistics came from, and also there's no verification. So they're just submitted. That's what I understand.
Oh, no, you're right. Kurt, is your name Kurt?
Yeah.
No, a lot of the data are suspect, but California is unique in that they don't report data at all. There is nothing, no records kept at all. And when the person in charge of these records from the state of California was interviewed by a Catholic newspaper, he said these data are highly political, and we just don't want to release them. So even though there's a law that says they have to, in 1967, the Therapeutic Abortion Act said you have to report or else you'll lose federal funds, California has consistently refused to report any abortion data.
You know, and that just makes me more curious when someone says, who knows the data that's not being released? When they say, this is highly political and we don't want to release it.
So you know there's a lot of Hispanic women in that data.
Yeah, I'm like, for heaven's sakes, we've just heard this week that Hispanics as a population have exceeded, as a proportion of the United States population, have exceeded the black population by a few percentage points, and that's
so
what I'm curious about.
You probably could make a good guess that in California, Hispanic abortions are pretty high. We know a little bit about Medi-Cal abortions in California because I've got that data, because the state pays $322 per abortion, and Californians in the whole state of California paid for 45,000 abortions. And Hispanics are seriously overrepresented in many parts of California. Like in Imperial County, Hispanics get 77% of all the Medi-Cal abortions. That's very high.
Steve is calling from his car. Steve, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I've done a little bit of study on the socioeconomics of abortion also. It's really, I'm really enjoying your guest. And I've got a question of, I'm well aware of the eugenics movement also, but I'm wondering if maybe anything has been studied as far as that disparity, whether is there more sexual promiscuity at younger ages in the black population that might account for this disparity also?
Okay, it's a good question, Steve. Let's see what Ann has to say.
He might know better than I. I don't have data. I have data certainly about visits to Planned Parenthood by race, whatever they'll release. But no, I don't have any really good data on, you know, age of onset for first intercourse by race, things like, I know that existed, but I would be on very thin ice saying I know that.
Well,
off
that,
the
that's,
top of my hand.
That's where my curiosity would lie, because I am wondering whether or not, I know you haven't done the research here, but I am wondering whether or not the age for the abortion has actually gone down. And I know in my own home state of Illinois, I'm broadcasting from St. Louis, but I actually live across the river. There is no parental consent. There is no parental notification law. And people cross state lines for abortions in Illinois all the time. And it's with minor children.
Really?
That's what I'm curious about. Why isn't this, just the stuff that we do know, why isn't this more widely reported?
Because it's so politically incorrect. I mean, just this article that I wrote, I feel very grateful to the National Review Online, because my own San Diego Union-Tribune wouldn't touch stuff like this. It's hard to get a pro-life piece because this is viewed as pro-life, even though you're just... I don't say anything in the article about, well, let's stop this. There's no opinion there, even though I am pro-life. But and I think just bringing the data forward, I guess, could be viewed as pro-life. And it's very difficult to get pro-life information out there. We talk to each other. Your listeners are wonderful. But it's hard to get it beyond your listeners and to get it beyond the readers of National Review Online. People don't want to hear this stuff.
Do you think that the leaders, and I'm talking about the political leaders elected and otherwise, you mentioned Sharpton, not so much elected,
no,
though he's hoping for it, do you think they know this basic in its broad outline, or do you think they're ignorant of it?
I think they know this. How could they not know this? Almost, I mean, all of your, now your callers are very well educated, but the two callers we've had, and that could just be anecdotal, they both knew this. You knew this, Todd. It's just you had anecdotal information. You didn't have the confirmatory information. All they'd have to do is go online and type in abortion surveillance data, CDC, and you get it right on your screen. I can't believe they don't have a staff that knows this. But somebody like Sharpton, this is very uncomfortable data for him.
And how do you account for his continued support for the pro-choice cause, his appearance before NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and the platform that he's ready to run on?
I don't. That's what I'm floored by. You know, I don't. I can't understand it. When I see the Democrats, each one of them outdoing the other for how late you can get an abortion and how we're going to keep it so safe except for Gephardt, they all just are falling all over themselves. And the last Democratic convention, every speaker that was up there, and it just killed me, the Kennedys, because my family was very strong supporters of the Kennedys. I'm from Connecticut, and I didn't even know anyone who wasn't a Democrat growing up. I was a Democrat all the way. And now to see all these Kennedy kids up there saying we're going to keep a woman's choice and we're going to, you know, make sure that it's legal, I can't get over it. You know, I just can't. I don't know how the Democratic Party became the party of death.
Now, you mentioned Gephardt. You singled him out as one who's taking a slightly different tack among the six.
Well, he's at least against partial birth abortion.
And he has pledged publicly to vote, as a member of the House, to vote for a ban on partial birth abortion.
Yes.
How do you account, then, apart from, well, even including him, for white presidential candidates on the Democratic side, and they're, of course, going to be white Republican pro-choicers as well, how do you... Everyone wants to avoid, after Trent Lott and even before,
I know,
any possible taint of racism or discrimination. How do you account for their continued support and their ignorance, or seeming ignorance of it?
Well, yeah, ignorance is the better choice if we say they're just ignorant. Okay, maybe they won't be ignorant anymore if they are, maybe someone will tell them about this data. Maybe, I don't know, maybe one of your listeners will tell his or her representative. I can't believe they would be that ignorant, but maybe they are. But, you know, people know things and they choose to ignore them. You know, I don't understand how anyone can support abortion because we know it's killing. Something dies there, you know? I mean, but people overlook that. You know, people even on my own campus, I have debates all the time because I'm pretty active in the pro-life community, not certainly picketing or things like that, and writing. I've been writing about it. People will say, oh, why do you do this? And it's a woman's right to choose. And when I get into the conversation, they have to agree that there something dies in an abortion, but they're okay with that. You know, so they're okay with the killing that's involved in an abortion. I just don't understand it. So people can live with certain things. And it's much easier to do a grandstand play on, you know, racial disparity in casualty data in a war with Iraq, because then he looks like, you know, he's concerned about his community, and they all do. You know, everybody's jumping on that bandwagon, which is insulting to many of the people who volunteer to serve. My own son is a senior in high school. He's excited about going to college next year. He's going to be going to West Point, and he's very excited. And that's why when Sharpton and all at Rangel said, well, you know, it's just the people who don't have other choices, that's insulting to me and to my son and to all of us as parents who have children in the military and the armed forces. It's like, oh, no, he couldn't get in anywhere else, so he's going to West Point. That makes me mad.
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago that then President Bill Clinton, especially, and this was right around the time of the FDA ratification of RU486, said he reiterated what he'd been saying for years as kind of the centrist Democrat, I want to see that abortion is safe, legal, and rare. Well, it's the rarity here that we're talking about, isn't it?
It is.
And it would seem that of all people, the centrist Democrats, everyone wants to be the new Democrat, would be the first to say it's not rare enough, especially among blacks. Why don't they say that?
I guess because it's political suicide, because so many women want abortion. I don't understand it, because I think the tide is turning. I really do. This celebration of Roe v. Wade was just so far over the top that people said, hey, wait a minute, this is nothing to celebrate, 40 million dead. It's nothing to celebrate. So I think they're going to learn, but maybe not fast enough, because people still want to keep that option. And I don't think that we have to overturn Roe v. Wade, although I'd love to see it. I think if we can just get the culture to change with enough work on your part that you do already and your listeners and me writing, we can make a difference, because laws don't matter if the culture is not going to support. You know, Roe v. Wade, I don't know why everybody makes such a big deal out of it. Even the year before abortion was legal federally, there were over 600,000 abortions in the country, because in states like California, you had legal abortion since 1967.
Now, as one who has contact with college students, I want you to confirm or deny, if you would, an observation, and I've heard of, again, this merely anecdotally, that young women entering university are generally about 80% pro-life. But when they leave the university, that is flip-flopped toward the pro-choice 80%.
I don't know the statistics, but just you're right, Todd. Anecdotally, I see it, because they have to perform for their professors. Not so much in my school, because there is a strong pro-life community, and these kids come in as pro-life and they leave pro-life. I'm an advisor to the pro-life students on, it's called Students for Life, and we bring in speakers. We had Feminists for Life represented in October during Respect for Life Week. So I'm lucky. I'm really lucky. But even on my campus, there's a strong pro-choice community that students have to be careful in those classes to answer the questions the right way, because they could be viewed as deviant. That's what I study, deviants, and now the pro-life people are viewed as deviant. But I think that's changing. I really think the culture is changing.
Well, I hope that you are right. Keep up the good work, Anne.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Anne Hendershot is professor of sociology at the University of San Diego, author of the new book, The Politics of Deviance. Right after this break, I will tell you how you can receive the book for yourself. And Dr. Hendershot has also written a column for National Review titled Black Americans and Abortion, The Real Racial Disparity. When we come back from this break, Pastor Tom Baker joins us here live in Studio A. We'll continue with part four of our seven-part series on a theology of glory versus a theology of the cross. And we're going to talk a little bit about free will when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.